Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a it's a rainy spring day, but as we all know, supposedly April showers will bring May flowers, and we're already seeing signs of putting that horrible winter behind us. This is your host, John Gresham, and you are here listening to Military Monday, and we have with us one of the most extraordinary guests we've had since the show came on. This is a lady who you are going to find has truly done it all in her life. She's been a wife, a mother, a housemaker, graduated the University of Washington. She's also something else, and that's what the story is all about. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce you all to Sandy Grimes. Sandy, are you there?
I'm here, John.
And what is that other little thing you did that I didn't mention?
Oh, my gosh. It was just a small thing in my life and the life of my friend and CIA legend, Gene Burdafe. We identified a traitor in CIA in our organization, and he happened to be one of our coworkers, Aldrich James, or Rick, as he's known to us.
Now, you are a supremely modest lady, as many others have observed. What did you do in your roughly two decades at the agency? What was Sandy Grimes' profession while she was working at Langley and for the Central Intelligence Agency?
Almost all of my 26 years in CIA was working in the Soviet and East European Division on our Directorate of Operations. While there, I guess I became an expert on the two Soviet intelligence services, the KGB and the GRU, and I supported our operations in that field and with particular emphasis in the early part of my career with operations, our recruited sources. I was very involved in the headquarters end of some of these operations, as well as supported a couple of them from the field on occasion.
So you were what I believe is technically known as a case officer at various times in your career, correct?
Yes, but a headquarters-based case officer, and that's really something that I developed into. And I think probably the culmination was in the early 80s, I was given the job of heading an operational branch, directing our activities against the Soviet and East European targets in Africa.
Now, it needs to be said that along with being a rather talented scholar and obviously having a pretty good mind, there are a lot of superlatives that have been associated with you by your coworkers and by people still at the agency. As we've promoted this interview this week, I have had people on Twitter and Facebook describe you as a living legend. Your coworkers at the time described you as ravishing and one of the most formidable minds they ran into. What do you say to those kinds of superlatives being applied to a young lady who had to go and take your CIA entrance exam and ditch a University of Washington football game once upon a time?
Oh, I think that things, as we get, come larger than life. I'd certainly like to know who those people were who called me ravishing. I love that one.
Post articles that right after Ames got busted, you were being described as movie star and model good looks.
Oh, geez, my mother would be happy.
Well,
because I
good
look
genes.
Just like her. Good genes, exactly, exactly. You know, I was just a regular girl of the 1960s. I had an opportunity to come to Washington to work for CIA. I met such exciting people who were in the Directorate of Operations. And, you know, it was sort of we all progressed together. And I would say you can't imagine a more talented bunch of individuals. And as we worked as a team, and we made each other shine.
Talk more about you working as part of a team at CIA, but we need to also say that you and your friend Jean and some other very talented people had a very serious job in the 1990s, and that was you were hunting for that most elusive and dangerous of enemy assets, a mole inside your own organization. Talk a little bit about the man you were hunting. And let's start by talking a little bit about Rick Ames. Who is he? What was he? And how did he evolve in your mind? Because you knew him from the time you came into the agency, did you not?
Yes, I knew him pretty early on in my career. I would say Rick Ames, just on the surface, and the Rick Ames that I certainly knew in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and through the early part of the 80s, was an average American guy. I liked Rick. He was happy-go-lucky. He was sort of a gentle sort, certainly an absent-minded professor type. Rick was born in River Falls, Wisconsin. Later on, I guess he was probably about 10, his father, who had a PhD in Burmese history, decided to leave his academic life in River Falls and moved the family to McLean, Virginia, and to a job at CIA. Shortly after that, I guess early 50s, he took the family to Rangoon, Burma. He was a CIA employee at the time, and it was a disastrous tour. He was ill-suited for that work, but nevertheless, he remained with the agency. Oddly enough, in certainly what was in those days, the dumping grounds for people who were not terribly successful abroad, and that was the counterintelligence staff. Rick went to high school, McLean High School, good student, off to the University of Chicago. Didn't last terribly long. Lazy, partied, and eventually returned to Virginia, to McLean, and worked part-time at CIA as a clerical employee. All the while, he worked full-time at the CIA. Part-time, he attended George Washington University, where he graduated in the late 1960s. I think that's about the first time I met him. We grew up together, really, as employees in Soviet operations. Rick went off to his first tour, which happened to be a disaster. He spent two or three years in Ankara, Turkey, along with his new wife, who happened to also be a CIA employee. He comes back from Ankara and assigned to the Soviet East European Division, and then off to New York from about, 75 until 81.
And it's worth saying, you knew this man. You carpooled with this man. You socialized with this man. This was not an unknown individual to you.
Exactly, exactly. No, Rick and I were together in between his Ankara assignment and his assignment to New York. I never met his first wife, though. And in those days, many of the young CIA employees, we all lived in Reston, Virginia, because it was a place we could afford to buy houses. And, again, we carpooled because it was cheaper that way. No, I knew Rick quite well. And as I say, he was a happy-go-lucky guy. I enjoyed his company. There was nothing particularly special about him. He certainly, he was bright, and he considered himself to be very smart and very intellectual. I think maybe he thought he was smarter than a number of us, but he never held it above you. As I say, he was a pretty calm guy. And though what happened in 1981, Rick took a lateral assignment from New York to Mexico City. And that was to change the direction of his life, as it turns out. His first wife remained in New York. She did not want to go to Mexico with Rick. She had a job. She was perfectly content. So while he was in Mexico, he was a geographic bachelor. And it was during that period that he met his second wife, to be Rosario Dupree, who was a third secretary of the Colombian Embassy in Mexico City. Anyway, an affair. He fell in love, and in 83, Rick has to return to Washington. His tour is over, and he's assigned to a position back in the Soviet East European Division. And in this particular case, this job, he was a branch chief, gave him access to all the information about our Soviet sources, human sources, ones we had recruited. Shortly
and
after his return.
Let us just say that Rick was not the strongest of personalities, as you've described him in your book, in that he drank a lot, might even be described as having had a drinking problem. And his new love, Rosario, was a demanding and expensive mistress.
Yes, she was. And she was flying back and forth from Colombia, here to Washington to spend time with Rick. And obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, Rick had not told his first wife about this lady who was living with him for fairly long periods. Additionally, she brought her mother. So both Rosario and her mom loved to shop. And here's Rick. I mean, he can't afford to keep them to pay the bills. So this continued until about 1985. And Rick finally, we still aren't quite certain when he told his wife about Rosario. But she was pushing to be married, she, Rosario. And Rick was facing a divorce. He was going to have to split the proceeds. There weren't many with his first wife. And he knew he could not keep up with Rosario. So he decided that the only option he had, he really did love Rosario, was he had to sell a product. And that product was treason. He could get plenty of money for walking into the Soviets and volunteering his services. And that's indeed what he did on 16 April 1985. He walked into the Soviet embassy. At that time, it was on 16th Street, downtown Washington.
It was the old Pullman House, was it not?
You know, I don't know that. I know it's right. There was the Shoreham Hotel. I bet you're right.
Yeah, we all knew where the Pullman family had their mansion and then was later taken over by the Soviets after the revolution.
Yeah, see, I did not know that. It's right next to the current University Club, too, another beautiful old home, I suspect, originally.
And he walks in,
right.
And what does it give them? What does this strange phenomenon called a walk-in do when he walks into a foreign embassy and says, "Hi, I work at the CIA, and I'd like to go and commit treason against my country"?
Well, he had a little bit of a plan at the time, and this is terribly important. In the early 1985, Rick, in Alias, was attempting to develop a Soviet arms control specialist assigned to the embassy here in Washington. This man's name was Chivakin. He was not a Soviet intelligence officer or even a co-optee or agent. He was just what we said he was, arms control specialist. Now, this was not unusual that Rick would be in contact with someone like this. In those days, then, I don't know about now, the FBI had insufficient manpower to cover the target. So often, officers from the Soviet East European Division would help them out with their developmentals. So that was the genesis of Rick's contact with Mr. Chivakin. He reported his meetings with Chivakin once they finally started to occur, both the CIA headquarters as well as the FBI, and everybody was happy. So that particular
day, they all thought it was a normal recruitment, correct?
It was a normal developmental at this point, exactly. That particular day, Rick was supposed to have a lunch with Chivakin at the Mayflower, that 16 April. Chivakin really didn't want any part of this, and he kept standing Rick up. So after, and again, Chivakin didn't show the Mayflower. So Rick threw a couple of vodkas down, and he was already prepared. He had an envelope which contained the name of the KGB chief in Washington at the embassy. Inside was another envelope which had the KGB chief's pseudonym or code name on the inner envelope. So Rick walks through the door of the embassy. He introduces himself as so-and-so in Alias. I'm here to meet Chivakin. And he hands the envelope at the same time to the receptionist. And, of course, the receptionist sees the name of the – everybody knew who the KGB resident was. And that's how that was his first meeting and his first objective. He does not meet with Chivakin. He meets with the resident. His first objective is to establish his bona fides, right? Having a CIA officer who tells him his true name come through the front door, obviously they're going to think provocation. So in this first contact, Rick provides them with the names of two or three, I can't recall, KGB walk-ins are being handled by our station in Moscow. He feels, because we think these walk-ins are not legitimate, they're controlled by the KGB. So Rick passes these to the KGB. Additionally, he provides a list of the telephone numbers and names of the personnel in the Soviet East European Division from the top down through deputy branch chief, I think. And he asks for $50,000. He tells them he understands.
What do the Soviets think of this?
Well, Rick also understood that obviously they were going to have to go back to their headquarters, right, and evaluate this. He did, though, at the time, tell them that he wanted to maintain the contact here in Washington through his developmental Chivakin, right? It's already reported. He has cover for action. The FBI knows about it. The CIA knows about it. And nobody will be any the wiser. And that is the how the contact was made maintained from that time until Rick's departure the following year in July 1986, when he and then his new wife, Rosario, left for 3 years on an assignment to Rome. So that was the first thing he had to do. This was going to establish his bona fides.
Before he left, yep. He was able to go and do several additional dumps of data to them, was he not?
Yes, and how the dumps were, he'd have a meeting with or lunch with Chewbacca, and Rick would bring a bag of documents or information, and he and Chewbacca would change bags. Chewbacca would have a bag he'd give Rick that either had money in it or instructions on the subsequent contact. The most important information, damaging certainly from a human life perspective, was it was early June of 1985. The KGB has accepted Rick for what he is, a penetration of CIA. That particular meeting, or exchange, I should say, Rick provides the names of all of our current reporting human forces on the Soviet Union, KGB and GRU staff officers. He also gave his KGB handlers the names of those sources who were dormant or long retired from service.
So in other words,
devastating.
He has basically handed over the death warrants for most of these people.
Oh, absolutely. And it's in some respects it's even more disturbing because Rick Ames knew exactly what was going to happen to these individuals. They'd be arrested, interrogated, tried, sentenced, and executed. And in all cases, it was a bullet to the back of the head. And he was certainly aware of that. That was not news to Rick.
And it wasn't going to be good for the families of these people either. They were going to suffer as well, correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Careers were ruined. They were never trusted again. They lost their jobs. Homes were taken. They were taken to La Fortova and interrogated. Yeah, yeah. Many, many lives were affected besides just our assets. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about those assets. We use the term assets, but these were people. These were human beings. And let's talk about a couple of those human beings. One of them, the highest-ranking GRU member, that's Soviet military intelligence, for those not familiar with the difference between Soviet military intelligence, the GRU, and the Ministry of Internal Security, the KGB. Talk a little bit about the general and what you know about him and his story.
Oh, one of my favorite people. General Dmitry Polyakov was not just the highest-ranking GRU officer this government has ever handled, the highest-ranking Soviet intelligence officer across the board. He had over a 20-year history of cooperation with our government, and he was known as our crown jewel. From a personal standpoint, more than half of my 26 years with CIA, my career was entwined with this case, starting from the second month after I joined the agency as a 21-year-old who I don't even think I heard of the KGB, let alone the GRU. And just for your listeners, the GRU is the main intelligence directorate of the Soviet General Staff. The general, as I say, over 20 years with him, he volunteered in New York during a second tour. He was assigned to the Soviet military mission with the United Nations, volunteered in this particular case, obviously New York, to the FBI. And this was late 1961. They met him for about 6 months until he returned to Moscow in June 1962. And it was a little bit before that time that CIA was made aware of the case, because we were the only ones who could maintain communications with him during his tour in Moscow. We had some exchanges. It was with during his tour in Moscow before he came out again in late 1965. And always, most of the time, it was always impersonal communications with Polyakov. He didn't want anything else. And it was always at his instigation. He wanted to do it that way. He considered himself, and he was, an expert in internal communications. So we were not dealing with someone who didn't know the ground rules. And he trusted himself a lot more than he trusted us. He was there for about 3 years, and he came out late 1965 to Rangoon, Burma, as a GRU resident, the man in charge, as well as Soviet military attaché. Initially, the FBI reestablished contact with Polyakov in Burma. Obviously, a little unusual, but it made perfect sense since they were the last ones who were in touch with him. Everything went fairly well for a short time. A problem developed, and it was a language problem. Polyakov had not been using his English for 3 or 4 years, and it was not as good as it was when he was in the States. And his FBI case officer, John Mabee, didn't speak Russian. This was okay for normal requirements, but when it came to the discussion of positive intelligence and lots of the detailed military matters, you just had to have someone who could speak Polyakov's language. So that's when CIA took over the case, and we ran the case throughout huge years of cooperation with us. I went back to Moscow in 69. He came back out assigned to New Delhi, India, 1974. And this is where we really, both he and we, got a hold of that brass ring. That's where he was promoted to the rank of general. And with that, as well as with his contacts, obviously at GRU headquarters, it afforded him access that we were just along for the ride, and it was quite a ride, the type of information he was able to provide for us. You know, he photographed the pouches from headquarters to the field station, and his field station back to headquarters. He would make copies of cables when he could. And obviously, every time he went back to Moscow between his tour in Burma and India, and then back to Moscow from the first India tour, then he came back out to India for a second tour, which I will discuss and talk about in just a second. And during these Moscow assignments, he had... the access was just mind-boggling, and he photographed and photographed and photographed so many documents, which he would pass to us via dead drop. Unfortunately, in 1979, he returned to India, again as military attaché, obviously with the rank of general. The number of assignments available to him were limited simply because of his rank. There were not a lot of positions abroad in the GRU that garnered the rank of general for the military attaché. There was obviously India, there was Tokyo, and there was Beijing. So Polyakov is back in India, and a little less than a year later, he receives a cable from Moscow asking him to return to the Soviet Union, to Moscow, to participate in a military attaché conference. Now, this was unexpected news to him, certainly unexpected to us, and given a case, handling a case of a person of his rank and stature, you never want to have unexpected things happen in any operation, but particularly one like this. However, we had no reason to believe that this was not occurring. And given given the reputation he had in the GRU, he would certainly have been a participant. So the last meeting with Polyakov, he told our officer, said, you know, what happens if you are unable to return for some reason? He said, not to worry about me. I have my, another part, one of his, I have my unique. It's a two-way, high-speed piece of equipment that was developed specifically for Polyakov. It would encrypt, we would be able to communicate via this easily. We certainly had the dead drops. And he left India, and we never heard from him again.
And he was one of over a dozen individuals. I mean, without going into great detail, there was one that affected my career a great deal, who I never knew about until decades after he died, and that was a gentleman named Tolkachev, who was a chief designer at the at one of the primary electronics design houses there. I mean, you had people on this list that Rick Ames had handed over who were absolutely covering the full spectrum of what you wanted to know about, didn't they?
Absolutely. Now, with Tolkachev, you and I were in the same we were in the same pot. I didn't know about Tolkachev either. It was very tightly held. Again, you're correct. He was a Soviet military electronics expert, not an intelligence officer. And as it turns out, Rick also did not know about Tolkachev. And he was compromised, I'll work backwards, by Edward Lee Howard.
Okay, so he was
Exactly. He was compromised by Howard. And just a little bit of background on Howard, he was a CIA officer who was scheduled to go to Moscow as part of the preparation. He had to be repolygraphed, and there were problems, and Howard was fired. He subsequently volunteered to the KGB. And because he had been trained to handle, to participate in the Tolkachev case, he was aware of it. And it's our understanding that shortly after he volunteered to the Soviets in 1984, either the end of 84 or beginning of 85, he provided them with the information on Tolkachev. This case is terribly important for a couple of reasons. From a positive intelligence standpoint, he photographed hundreds and hundreds of pages, very much like Polyakov did. In this particular case, it was detailed notes, as well as notes and documents, on Soviet military weaponry long before it was deployed. So our U.S. military, once this was disseminated to them, they were able to redirect, in many cases, our R&D efforts because they had the plans, what the Soviets were building, and it saved the U.S. government billions of dollars. The other thing that was important about Prokhorov, and this is from my parochial view, we were able to demonstrate, CIA, Moscow Station, that it was possible to have personal meetings with a recruited Soviet asset under the watchful eye of the KGB. It was important in the case of Prokhorov because he was not an intelligence officer. He didn't know about spying. And we had well over 20 personal meetings with him. And he was compromised, as I say, because of a traitor, not because he or we made any mistakes.
What happened to General Polyakov? How was he arrested, and what was his fate?
The general was not arrested until July 1986. Now, once the Soviets started to arrest people, it's not that they already didn't know he was a spy, but their first thing they had to do is arrest those who were abroad, right? Because they didn't want them defecting. And so the general could sit there, and they didn't have to worry about him. He wasn't going anyplace. So what they did was, he was at his dacha, and he was arrested one day after his 65th birthday, and he was asked to come to GRU headquarters to participate in an awards ceremony. He put on his uniform, and they picked him up right away. He was taken to Lefortovo, where he was interrogated, and he was executed after the trial. We did not learn of his execution until 1988, although there's no question we certainly had some indications that he was not in the clear. But I have to say, for Jean and myself, I can speak for us, we knew that it would be a miracle that he had been one of the few to survive. But because, you know, he had been run for so many years and he was a legend, it was difficult for us to accept, and we somehow just believed that maybe he could escape this mess, but he didn't.
Now, General Polyakov was one of a large number of people who were exposed by Ames and Howard and others. And 85, 86 must have been like a bad horror movie for people in your business, watching these assets being rolled up and presumably killed. What you were just talking about, what you and Jean felt like knowing this about Polyakov, what was the attitude around your division in the Directorate of Operations as you watch all of these people who you've worked so closely with just disappear into a black hole?
Well, you have to remember, again, the old need-to-know principle, and these were restricted handling cases. There were very few people who were aware of the cases. And at the time, in 1985, I was only aware of one, and that happened to be the case of Colonel Polistuk, that my branch, the Africa branch, was running. Polistuk and my association had gone back 11 years earlier to his days in Kathmandu, Nepal, where I had the opportunity to support the case for a time. He was a KGB officer who volunteered to us. in Kathmandu. We had been out of touch for 10 years when he appeared in Lagos, Nigeria in early 1985. So it was my branch that was responsible for handling the case. In the summer of 85, he went back to Moscow on home leave, and we owed him money from his time in Kathmandu, and he did not want to take it back on his person during what he wanted it during home leave. So we decided that the easiest way to get it to him was just to put the money in a dead drop in Moscow, and there'd be no problem. It wasn't spying. You know, if he was caught picking it up, it could be black market. As it turns out, he was arrested, and this was in August. I learned about it in October. So, as far as I knew, I was the only one who lost a source. I didn't learn of the other ones until January 1986, when I was called in to the chief of the division, Burton Gerber's office, and I was told about the others that we had lost, one by one by one. And there was we had no explanation as to the reason for their disappearance or their loss. It had never happened before. It was unprecedented. And the reason I got called in, it was triggered by the appearance of a news source in January 1986. And I was asked to handle the headquarters end of this operation. You couldn't believe it. You could not believe that this had occurred. And an additional burden that this small group of us had is you always ask yourself, did we do something wrong operationally which led to their deaths? And that's a burden. A number of us in the Directorate of Operations who were involved in these cases had to carry for the next 8 years until we finally identified our problem, and that problem was Rick Ames.
Now, about this time, this new source, you put into effect new handling and security procedures. They seemed to work. But at the same time, you obviously were all asking yourself the question, okay, if we didn't screw up, who's the rat? Who's the mole? Where did the source of this leak come from? What was the early consensus within your division regarding the question of who and what was responsible?
Basically, during this period, all the action took place in two components in the Directorate of Operation. One, the Soviet East European Division, right, with responsibility for handling assets, and the other is the counterintelligence staff or center. They have the investigative responsibility. The consensus was two theories, each pretty obvious. We either have a traitor, communications have been compromised. They're reading our traffic. And since we didn't know which, when we got the news source, we had to guard against each. To handle the traitor part of the equation, we simply instituted what we've always called set time draconian security measures by severely limiting the number of people who knew about the news source to
so
really
very heavy compartmentalization of the material.
Absolutely. Really strict. To handle the staff the problem or potential problems with staff communications relative to Soviet operations, we simply ignored it. There was never any cable traffic between headquarters and this new case, between headquarters and the concerned field station where the source was located. We went back to basics. Sent an case officer from headquarters indirectly to the source's location. While there, he met the asset in a safe house. He returned to his hotel room, where he would transfer the meeting results to a laptop computer and then encrypt it. After completion of the meeting schedule, he'd return to headquarters where we would decrypt the results. And as I always say in my talks, obviously today a laptop computer with encryption capabilities is not out of the ordinary.
It was state-of-the-art back then.
It was state-of-the-art, and oh, my God, it wasn't the most user-friendly.
All right.
There were days I wasn't – go ahead.
Please finish up because we're going to take a quick break after this.
Okay. There were days I wasn't so certain I would ever be able to get those meeting results in clear text.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break for some network messages. And when we come back, we're going to have Sandy tell the story of how they found Aldrich Ames. With that, we will be back with you in just a moment.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Right Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham, Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
And with that shameless promotional plug of me, we are back, and we are talking to former CIA case officer and spy hunter, Sandy Grimes. Sandy, are you still with us here?
I'm here.
All right. Now, it's now the late 1980s, early 1990s, and Rick Ames is back from his overseas assignment, and he is just dumping things on the Russians. I mean, he goes and gives them enough that the normally tight-fisted Russians pay him $4.2 million. I mean, that's a lot of cash. And he begins to go and live a $4.2 million lifestyle, does he not?
Well, he did begin to live an extravagant lifestyle. And you have to remember, this is a person who had no care, had no concern in anything material in his life. That was the Rick Ames I knew before Rosario. But when they came back from Rome in 1989, yes, they bought a big fancy, they bought a big house. There was no mortgage on it. He, of course, let everybody know that this was money from Rosario's family. And he said he was on a joyride. And the other thing that happened to Rick that I think is terribly important is this perfect absent-minded professor, who was really, as I said, a gentle soul, became one of the most arrogant, frightfully arrogant creatures I think I've ever seen. He was absolutely full of himself, normally stooped over. He was erect. He, as I said, was arrogant, and of course, beautifully dressed in the expensive Italian suits and shoes. His hair was perfectly coiffed. The Rick of old, I don't know, maybe washed his hair once every couple of weeks. It was just, and the other thing that was quite different, at least to me, is the gentleness was gone. He was a stranger. And he certainly, I think the other thing, Rick's career was going nowhere. By this time, he was well aware that classmates had done much better than he. And I'm certain that bothered him. You know, he wasn't being recognized for his brilliance by his colleagues. So in 1991... here we are, and in all honesty, we were no closer to finding out what happened in 85 and 86 than we were then. This was despite the fact that Jean, who had been in charge of trying to solve that mystery, there had been plenty of leads, but she and her people had investigated all of them, and they turned out to not be the answer to our problems. So by 91, early 91, Jean was facing mandatory retirement in 92, and she felt guilty that she had been unable to answer those questions, and she wanted to spend the rest of her time until retirement taking another fresh look at what happened in those years.
Now, we haven't talked a lot about her in this show, and I want to take a couple of minutes and have you tell us about your good friend, Jean.
Oh, thank you. Jean and I will say, I know she's listening to me. My good friend, Jean, passed away just about 16 months ago after a short and totally unexpected illness. She did live to see our book published, but we both knew she wouldn't be able to participate in any success it might enjoy. Jean and I first met one another in the mid-1970s, and I was the keeper of the files on the Polyakov case, and Jean was writing a paper on the GRU, and she had to come to Sandy. And that's when we met. I worked for Jean in the late 70s. We're two very, very different people. I'm outgoing, and she was not. Jean never married. She was devoted to her work. Obviously, when we spent these years writing, this book together, we became good friends. Sort of a little thing that always makes me laugh. During every single week for probably 10 years, I would call Jean after Final Jeopardy. And we would, it was our contest. Eventually, we let my husband join in, Gary. And we would, okay, did you get this right? Did you get this right? And we'd keep score. We did that for 10 years. So we had obviously a very close relationship.
And there's another individual who becomes an important part of the story at this point, a gentleman by the name of Paul Redman. Talk about him.
Oh, Redman. You know, it's funny. I don't call him Paul very often. I always call him by his last name. Wonderful, wonderful individual. One of my dearest friends. Jean and I thought the world of him. Redman had been deputy chief of counterintelligence within the Soviet East European Division in 1985, in 1986, when our disaster happened. Eventually, he became deputy chief to Burton Gerber. And so he was one of a handful of people who was aware that all of these cases were disappearing. As I say, I didn't learn about it until early 86. Eventually, Redman transferred from the Soviet East European Division as deputy chief to the Counterintelligence Center, where Jean was working. And this happened in 1991. And in large part, the establishment of what became known as the Ames-Mole Hunt team really was the creation of Paul Redman. And he deserves a great deal of credit for our success. As I said, Jean felt guilty about not being able to solve our mystery. And shortly after Paul arrived in the counterintelligence center, he and Jean went to FBI headquarters to discuss a matter totally unrelated to those earlier losses. The Bureau had also experienced some in their Soviet operations during the same time period. After the meeting, Redman just happened to mention Jean was going to take another look at the cases. The Bureau asked if they could join. Redman said, of course. That same afternoon, he came back to headquarters, called me, and asked if I would like to join Jean. He knew I was planning on resigning from the agency, and that only an opportunity to determine why we had lost General Polyakov and Colonel Polishchuk would keep me working. So that's how we started. The two guys from the Bureau, both wonderful guys, Special Agent Jim Holt and Soviet Analyst Jim Milburn, later joined us. And about a year after that, we added a fifth and terribly important member to our team, young CIA Office of Security employee Dan Payne, who was the one who handled all the information and activities related to Rick's finances once he became our primary suspect.
Now, you look so today at the class photo of you guys together, and you're saying, and this is the group that took down arguably the worst internal spy the agency had up to that point. I mean, I don't know that I would call any of you formidable looking, and yet the process you went through, and we're going to talk about that for a few minutes here right after we get done, was scientific, it was analytical, it was responsible, it was data-driven, and also had a little bit of serendipity and magic associated with it. So let's ask the question. So you guys go and get moved to a little bank of offices.
One little office.
One little office.
Oh,
and
that was terrible.
You probably have to take turns sitting down.
We did.
And you then spend the next 3 years of your lives hunting a man. A man, by the way, that you are daily bouncing off of right there in the same damn building you're working in, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Okay, so I summarized that accurately. Okay. How did you do it? Where did you start?
Well, I have to make one comment. We really were a motley-looking crew. I sort of agree with you. You never suspect that we could hunt spies, let alone catch one. What we did, and Gene was the one, Gene gets the credit for this. The first thing is pretty obvious. Our list of suspects were those people within CIA employees, who knew about one or more of the cases we lost. Initially, after some pairing, that list totaled about 160 individuals. And we've got a problem. We can't, the four of us can't investigate 160 people. You have to have an army to do that. So Jane decides what we are going to do is we are going to have all four members of our little team plus six others, two from the FBI and four from CIA, down on a piece of paper. Now, they're working by themselves. We don't discuss this with anyone. This is our personal opinion. We search in our souls, each of us.
And you're taking a blind poll here.
Exactly, yes. The names of five or six people who, and I'm going to use the word we used, who made them uneasy and whom they believed that we should take a close look at. Now, don't forget, right, we're looking for a traitor here. So by uneasy, it's not someone you had an argument with. This is pretty serious business. We also asked everyone to put these names in order, the one that made them the most uneasy or bothered them the most in first place, and so on down.
So you told them each of your nominees.
Yeah, we wanted them to rank their nominees, and then we took their submissions and she and I added a numerical value to the rank order. Buddy, whose name was in first place, got 6 points. Second place, 5 points. And then we totaled the number of points. And what a surprise. Rick Ames.
And the winner was?
Rick Ames. We went, whoa. Yeah, Rick Ames. Now, there were some who had, he had 21 points. There were some who had 16, 18. Also, I do have to say, we didn't ignore everybody else who remained on the list, the original list of 160, but we certainly did concentrate on those on our new short list, and eventually Rick became our primary suspect.
And how many points did Rick have out of the possible 60?
As I recall, he had 21. Well, it wasn't 60 points. We just told he had the most points of everybody who appeared on somebody's list. He
agreed.
Had 21
and this
points.
Thing, if you had 10 people, each of whom could have a six-point person, in theory, if everybody agreed, it would have been a 60-point winner.
Oh,
but getting a 21-point winner is still pretty interesting.
Yeah,
and
21.
And what can you say about how the people who gave him these top points? I mean, were these a combination of people from the Bureau and the agency, or was it just people who knew it?
I have to say, and again, this is my recollection, because a lot of this happened a long time ago. I was the only one who made him number, who gave him first position. He was first on my list. And as Gene says, and this is in the book, quoting Gene, of all those who voted, only Sandy gets the gold star. Jim Olson, who was chief of the Counterintelligence Center, he had him as number two, as I recall. Redman had him on his list. I think he had four or five people, I don't remember. And he was first on Redmond's list, but he hadn't numbered them. And so when Gene asked Redmond, excuse me, is he first? He says, I don't know, I just put those things down. She said, typical Redmond. So obviously I knew Rick. Jane knew Rick very well too, but she put him as fourth. We voted again though, sometime later. And as she said,
now,
she moved him up the second.
Now, we had this talk yesterday, and
yeah.
I need to tell you, what you were using is a technique we use in game and simulation design called a Monte Carlo, which takes into account personal experience, sometimes of decades. Did you guys have a sense that there was something more to your looking at Rick and certain other people as candidates and suspects, that it had more to do with your personal experience and how things worked in the business, or was it based on hard evidence?
I don't think it wasn't based on hard evidence at all. Certainly, those of us at CIA who voted knew Rick better than those knew Rick, but from the Bureau, and so did Jim Milburn, but not to the extent that Sandy knew him, or Redmond, or Gene, you know, because we grew up together. And it's, as Gene and I have always said, we couldn't have found a traitor in the FBI because we didn't know the people. And we didn't know how the game was played. That is something that certainly helped us because we knew the actors in this play.
To say that just a few years later, the FBI had to do it themselves to Robert Hansen. So it was not a unique experience you had.
No. But, you know, I guess we thought it was. We thought it was
simple. Well, you were first.
It sort of made sense to us. It made sense to us. It made sense to two ladies. Go ahead.
You've got your list of nominees. You've got a totem list of people that you think, okay, let's look at these people.
Right.
And you have done something new, which is you've brought in a finance geek to look at their lifestyle from a financial point of view. What happens when that guy takes a hard look at Rick Ames and the other top candidates?
Well, that's not quite how it happened. As I said, Dan did the finances, but he was the one who knew how to do national security letters. And what we did was he took the information from some of Rick's bank accounts as well as other avenues. I didn't pay too much attention to them. And yes, there was no question that Rick was getting fairly large sums of money. Initially, I think that $4 million, that might be, I don't know where that comes from. I know that the Soviets did hold money reportedly for Rick in Moscow, but I think that the total was more a little over $2 million, obviously lots of money. Now, what we didn't know was, after a time, it became fairly clear that whatever Rick was doing was illegal, immoral, or illicit. But what we could not get a handle on was whether it had to do with the Soviets. And one of the reasons there was a problem with respect to this was Rick traveled back and forth to Colombia all the time, to Bogota. That's where Rosario's mother was, his family, and he was handling their finances, reportedly. So, obviously, before 9/11, we couldn't be certain this wasn't drugs, right? We couldn't be certain it could have been emeralds. And I'd say the eureka moment occurred again, with Dan and the finances, and it was one August, early August, 1992 day, when Dan had just gotten information from one of the local banks where Rick and Rosario had an account. And among the information, there were three deposit slips, cash deposit slips. And as Dan finished putting this information on his spreadsheet on Rick's finances, he'd pass it over the cubicle wall to Sandy, who had also a chronology of all the information we CIA had on Rick's activities, badge in and outs, you name it. That particular day, I took one of the deposit slips, and I think it was for 21 May, and it was a cash deposit. Let's say it was for $7,000. The day before, Rick had had a lunch meeting. Remember Chuvakin, the Soviet Arms Control Specialist? And I thought, well, geez, that's a little unusual. The next deposit slip was for 5 July, 1985. There was no meeting with Chuvakin, obviously, 4 July, because it was a federal holiday, or 3 July also happened to be a federal holiday then, but there was a lunch, 2 July. And the last deposit slip, again cash, and below $10,000. The last deposit slip was for 31 July, 85, and that day he had had lunch with Chuvakin. So, I mean, that was it. As we say, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what was going on here. Rick was a Soviet spy. What was important, three things. One, these were after meetings with a Soviet national. They were all cash, and in each case was below the $10,000 reporting limit required by the banks, the feds had put on the banks at that time. And so that was our mini eureka moment. It was the first thing that would eventually lead to Rick's arrest and conviction.
How did the end game go in developing the actual case against Rick Ames? How did that go through 1993 and into early 94? I mean, obviously you wanted to get it done quickly so he wouldn't have a chance to sense that he was about to get busted. But at the same time, you wanted to have an airtight case so that you could get, so you could put him in the position of facing the death penalty and get maximum traction against him in terms of the damage assessment afterwards.
Right. Now, there wasn't a death penalty at that time for espionage.
Well, there was not.
No, it had been taken off the books. But as a result of Ames, it went back on the books. So Hansen was faced with that possibility. No, the most Rick could get was life without parole. However, the Bureau came in and they were able to get full coverage, because now it's going to be, we're not identifying who the mole is, we're just trying to prove it in a court of law. So there was complete coverage. Cameras where Rick worked, the telephones, complete coverage of their houses, of their house, beacons on cars. And I do have to say, during this period, you know, it really was difficult because you saw Rick almost every day. And I, in particular, you couldn't smoke in the building any longer, and I was smoking, and Rick was a heavy smoker. So I would go outside in the courtyard at noon to have a cigarette, but I'd always run into Rick because he was always there. And, of course, we were friends. So I stopped smoking because of that, because I was afraid he's going to know that we know. But, you know, in the end, he was shocked. He could not, he had no idea that any of this was coming. No idea.
Sandy, talk about President's Day, February 22nd, 1994. because it was a federal holiday that day. Talk about you, talk about Gene and Paul and the rest of your team, and what happened on that day.
Well, that was a special day for us, obviously. That was the day the Bureau was going to arrest Rick. Gene and I, and why are we going to work on a federal holiday? That's another thing you had to tell. I had to give a cover story to my husband. Come on, Sandy. It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, it was Gene, Sandy, Paul, Dan Payne, and there were some others from the Bureau. I don't remember their names. It was a small group. And I think one of our lawyers. Anyway, we were waiting in our old digs at CIA headquarters. The Bureau had set up a, hopefully Rick was going to confess, but a facility at their offices at Tyson's Corner. And we had Rick's boss in the counter narcotics center give Rick a call that morning, asking him to come in to answer a cable. Rick and his boss were scheduled to go on a TDY for a conference related to narcotics. And Rick said, sure. And obviously it was a ruse to get him out of the house. He gets in his car, and not far from the house, the FBI surround him, and he's arrested. And we get the phone call that he's in cuffs. It was wonderful. It wasn't a giant celebration, yay, yay, yay. I think it was complete relief. We did it. We never could have imagined, I think, in our wildest dreams, that it would come to, I think Gene and I and Paul, we all knew we'd be able to identify the person, but an arrest, that was a miracle for us. And I think there was a bottle of champagne. Everybody had a glass, I think in paper cups or, I don't know, plastic cups. We took a sip. I don't think any of us finished our little glass of champagne. It was just all such relief for us. And I always laugh the next day. Obviously, we were back at work. And, of course, the news of CIA, Aldrich Ames, Rick Ames being arrested. You could imagine how bad it was at the agency. People are just horrified. And but when the four of us got together early that next morning, I think it was Jean. I may have said something to her, and she said, I slept like a baby last night. This is not the kind of thing Jean would say to anyone. And the rest of us looked at one another, and somebody said, I did too. And we started to laugh. I don't think that we really comprehended the amount been under for a couple of years. But, you know, it was almost, yes, a job well done. That was sort of our feeling. We were happy, at least for a short time.
Now,
until the fallout occurred.
Well, and yes, I'm going to be the first to admit, having been a close observer of this over a period of years, you and your team got a lot of press at the time, which had to have been just mildly uncomfortable for you and Gene and Paul and the rest of your team, since you guys had been taught live in the shadows.
Yes. And it not only was it that press, but a year later, the agency wanted to get their side of the story out because the Bureau was getting their side of the story out. So had us participate in interviews with an individual who became one of our dear friends, Pete Early, who wrote a book on AIM. So here we are participating in these interviews. They're all done on agency property. But I have to say, it, as you mentioned, wait, we were not, this was not where we were to find ourselves. We were to walk away from this. Our stories were never to be told to anyone. We did our job. That was it. But Gene and I in particular, and I think it's because both of us were retired by that time, although Gene was back on contract, we were pushed up front more than some of the others. Had to appear, if you can imagine, two older women, Nightline, that was our Ted Koppel, that was our first introduction to the press. Oh my!
And
gosh.
I thought you looked great on Nightline.
Yes, but you can't imagine. Nobody tells us what to say, what not to say. We have no questions. We in advance. It was, we were deer in headlights, so to speak. But eventually we became more comfortable with it over the years, I guess. And that's
and
how
at
the
some
book
point
evolved.
You decide it's time to write a book about what you and Gene and your other friends on that team did in those years following 91 to 94.
Yes, and it was 9 years after Rick's arrest that we had finally become comfortable enough with it. We put pen to paper. And I think in particular, our lives had calmed down, and people had been after us to write our story. But for Gene and myself, the most important part was not our story and the story of our wonderful colleagues. It was the story of those who gave their lives. And she and I were in a unique position that we knew those cases quite well, and I have to say that if the agency had not allowed us to include those cases, if it were just the story of our involvement in the Ames Mole Hunt team, we wouldn't have had the book published. That wasn't important to us. It was important that the story of those who gave their lives, that those stories get out.
And let me just, to our listeners, if you have not had a chance to see Sandy and Gene's book called Circle of Treason from our friends at Naval Institute Press in Annapolis, take the time, pick up a copy, because it's more, as Sandy has said, it's not just the story of hunting a man. It's also the story of that man's victims and why these people were so intense to go and complete their mission. And please, add anything you care to that statement.
Well, I do have to say that obviously those of us involved in Soviet operations understood these were the big leagues. And when these individuals, these Soviet intelligence officers, or non-intelligence officer, Ministry of Foreign Affairs and such, agreed to work for the United States government, that they put their lives in our hands. And we, and by we, I mean CIA, we failed them. We certainly couldn't repay them for their sacrifices or their families for their losses, but we owed each and every one an answer. And as professional intelligence officers, we really owed ourselves an answer as to what happened. And so it really became a mission. We weren't going to let this one go. It was important that we found out what happened.
Okay, it's now a couple of decades later.
Yeah.
And we're all a little older. A little wiser, one hopes. Amazingly enough, you have continued on. You've written a book. You lecture about it from time to time. By the way, if you get a chance to listen to Sandy, her story is a compelling one to listen to as she tells it in front of you live. You've got the original equipment husband, Gary, still out there, having probably yes. been very proud of you the day you came home and admitted that you fibbed to him.
I don't dare tell that story. Oh, but I will. that particular morning, February 21st, he was flying out of Dulles to Los Angeles on business. And, of course, here I am, and he's saying, you know, I'm just an old lady here. And he's saying, why are you going to the office on a holiday? This makes absolutely no sense. And I looked at him, and I said, dear, have a safe trip. Give me a call when you get there, and listen to the news, please. He looked at me like I was out of my mind.
And, of course, this to the husband of a longtime CIA employee, getting a cue and a hint had to have perked up those ears.
Yes, he did. Well, the other thing, too, is Gary knew Rick. He had been to his apartment. He had been to the townhouse. No, Gary knew Rick. That wasn't. Yes. So he landed in L.A., and I guess it was about 11 o'clock out there. And he saw it on the TV screen as he was getting his baggage.
And he knew immediately, didn't he?
Yes. When I was on the task force, I told him in 91, he said, look it, you said you were going to resign. I said, I know. But, you know, I know all these old cases, so I'm just going to dig through the files. They've got to be retired. I mean, I said something stupid. And he said, I'm not asking anymore. I don't dare. You won't tell me anyway. I said, no. So, yeah, I guess, yeah, he was proud. The girls were beside them. They were really beside themselves. Well, they didn't know about it. Yes, they did. They did know about it. The two teenagers, they were teenagers by this time.
Which brings us to today. What's ahead for Sandy Grimes? What do you want to do next? I mean, you're a wife. You've got a nice home. You lecture. You've written a book about how you captured one of the great spies of all time. What do you want to do next?
Oh, my. I really think I might like to go back to retirement for a while and go back to genealogy. No, I don't know. I've had a very fortunate life and, you know, enjoy my family, enjoy my grandkids, enjoy my brothers and sisters. My husband and I are very, very fortunate because our family is located in this area. So we have many wonderful family get-togethers, and our good friends are here. And so, you know, take it one day at a time. You never know when it's going to be the last day, right?
Oh, we'll share that story about me one of these days. But, yes, Sandy, I want to thank you for coming on and giving us such a great telling of your story. And we will be talking again soon. But thank you so much for your service, for your dedication, and for being a great American. We appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you very much, John. It's been my pleasure. It's the story of wonderful, wonderful people who unfortunately had to meet a man named Rick Ames, but he's where he belongs.
Yes, he is. And with that, goodbye to our listeners. We'll talk to you again next week at 1 p.m. Eastern on Military Monday.